All right, it's time to get started. And fortunately, this week we had a preacher that could end on time, so we're not running late for the first time in a few weeks. We just had to fire the other guy in order to make that happen. I've got a couple copies left of this outline of Deuteronomy 12 through 26 if anyone doesn't have one and would like one. This is kind of the bulk of the text that we're working through over the next few weeks. Those of you who are visiting with us, congratulations, you landed in the middle of Deuteronomy. It's not quite as bad as landing in the middle of Leviticus, but it's pretty close. Of all of Deuteronomy, this is the law code, and you're here for it. We've actually, what we've done in this class is we've devoted a lot more time in the text of the sermons of Moses that aren't the law code. And what we've done, partly by decision, partly of necessity, partly making it up as we go, is spending three classes basically working our way through this law code. And what we're doing is spending the majority of our time reading the text. So we will, again, follow that same pattern that we did last week, where we'll spend a chunk of the time reading a large section of the text. We'll be reading 16, 18 through 20 today, these three sections of the text. And I'll break it up a little bit more than that when I read it. And I'll make just a few comments of things that I think are especially noteworthy, and we'll have some time for any comments or questions that come from the class as well. But this is not a normal sort of style of teaching for me in particular, but it means that you'll hear less of my thoughts, so maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing either. So that's the plan. One thing I did want to touch on from last week that was left over, there was that verse that we were reading as we were working our way through about the flying insects being unclean. And Charlie asked the question, and I sent this to him because I knew he wasn't going to be here, but he asked the question about how John the Baptist ate locusts when flying insects were unclean. What I didn't realize or remember, or maybe a little bit of both, is there is a verse in Leviticus that addresses the issue of flying insects more precisely and specifically talks about locusts being clean. So that's the answer to that question for anyone who remembered that all week long. Or needs to know, if you're preparing any locust and wild honey for the potluck, perhaps. Fortunately, though, everything's been made clean, so we don't even really have to worry about it. So that's what we're going to be working our way through. And the first piece of this has to do with Israel's leaders, which breaks down into some sorts of subgroups. We talked about way back at the beginning, and I mentioned it in passing last time, we're really not following the pattern that I originally intended to be following as we were going through this class, or this part of the class. And that is how some people see this law code as an expansion of the Ten Commandments and kind of commentary on the Ten Commandments and other laws that are derived out of those principles of the Ten Commandments. And there's all kinds of debate about that and how it all works out. And some see it as kind of a loose pattern. Some see it as a very strict pattern. Some see it as no pattern at all. But I do think there's something to it at least. So, for example, when we were talking about Israel's worship last week, you may remember that it begins with a lot of talk about how to worship God, and God is God alone, and you will not follow all these different idols, which are the first two commandments. And there is this emphasis in it on the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. God doesn't come out and say, you know, when the temple is built in Jerusalem, this is what you're to do. What he repeatedly says is the place where I will put my name, which, again, emphasizes that it's more about where God chooses to put his name and less about the exact location of Jerusalem specifically. And that kind of paves the way for Jesus saying the place of worship isn't important at all when you get to the New Testament. But again, that emphasis on God's name can't help but make you think of the Ten Commandments and not profaning the name of the Lord. And then we got to the laws about the Sabbath year in particular. And again, that brings you to the Sabbath law. Well, as we move to these leaders of Israel, most people that follow this idea of it being an expansion of the Ten Commandments see this in relation to honor your father and mother. Which might seem like a little bit of a stretch, but again, the beginning of authority for anybody in their life is at home with their parents. And every other kind of authority that you encounter and learn beyond that is something of an expansion of what you're learning at home to begin with. So there is at least the possibility that we're moving, if that framework is here in these laws, that we're moving on to another big picture principle, so to speak, which is the rule of authority that begins with the parents and then extends beyond that. One other thing that I'll say as we look at these four different categories, judges, kings, Levites, and priests, a couple things as we get into it. First of all, it's noteworthy that the way it's arranged, no single person could hold all four offices. You're very familiar with that, at least in terms of, you know, priest and king as it relates to Jesus and some of the difficulties with that and, you know, the priesthood according to Melchizedek rather than Levi and so forth. But ultimately what it means is no individual can have supreme authority over any other individual. It's a kind of separation of powers in the ancient world really is what it amounts to. But notice also the first place where this begins is not with the king. That's kind of what we would probably expect. I'm going to give laws on how society is to be run by the different rulers in society that are going to be in charge of different elements of your life in society. Number one, the king. I mean, that's kind of how we would think about things. That's not how this is put together. It's number one, the judge. And what the judge does is he enforces and interprets God's law. And then it ends with prophets who bring God's word. So it begins and ends not with political leaders, but with God's representatives. God's law and God's word is where this leadership begins and ends. And the judges will be God's representatives, so to speak, in enforcing his law. The king is really, as we'll see, I think, less of a reflection of the way of the Lord and more of a reflection of what an Israelite is supposed to look like, rather than who God is something of the judge is a representation of God. The king is a representation of people, at least he should be. So that kind of by way of backdrop, that'll save me some things to say later on. So beginning in Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 18, then, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not plant any tree as an Asherah beside the altar of the Lord your God that you shall make, and you shall not set up a pillar which the Lord your God hates. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or sheep, in which is a blemish, any defect whatsoever, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. If there is found among you within any of your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, in transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the hosts of heaven, which I have forbidden, and it is told you, and you shall hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently. And if it is true and certain that such an abomination has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has done this evil thing, and you shall stone that man or woman to death with stones. On the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to be put to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If any case requiring decision between one kind of homicide or another, or one kind of legal right or another, or one kind of assault and another, any case within your towns that is too difficult for you, then you shall rise and go up to the place that the Lord your God will choose, and you shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from that place that the Lord will choose. And you shall be careful to do according to all that they direct you, according to the instructions that they give you, and according to the decision which they pronounce to you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judge, that man shall die, so you shall purge the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again. All right, a couple of things about this. It really, what it boils down to is kind of the positive and the negative side. Positively, judge the people fairly, judge the people according to justice. Negatively, a little bit more precise, don't pervert justice, don't show partiality, don't accept a bribe. And I mean, that's fundamental. There's always going to be some injustice in society at large. But when the courts become unjust, when the place where there's supposed to be restitution and justice is unjust, then there's really no hope for justice at all. Now, 16:21 through 17:1 is a little bit of an odd thing popping up in the midst of all of this. I mean, 18 through 20 is clearly about justice. 17:2 through 7 is about justice. The high court issues in 8 and following is clearly about justice. Then there's this forbidden forms of worship thing that shows up in the middle. And I've not found anything that is definitive about how it all fits in. I think it fits somewhat, at least, with 17:2 and following about people following after other gods. And it may be as simple as that. It's a lead-in to this discussion of idolatry and the kinds of cases that they may be dealing with specifically. For example, here's the kind of case that you'll have to deal with. And that may be all there is there. Otherwise, it's a bit of an oddity. There is one thing there in verse 22 that's striking, because it's one of those words that I think we don't understand sometimes. You shall not set up a pillar which the Lord your God hates. Most of you who grew up in Christian homes probably were told not to say that word, you know, hate. Don't say you hate anybody. Sometimes even once, you know, you teach a child that very well, I almost said indoctrinate. Once you teach a child that very well, not to say they hate somebody, that anytime they hear the word hate, it's like a bad word to them. So what is God, the God of love, doing hating something? Well, obviously the simple answer is it's idolatry, it's evil, God hates that. But in bigger picture than that, particularly in the context of Deuteronomy, remember that love is not just an emotional feeling, it's a covenant term. God's love for His people is His covenant loyalty to His people. The fact that He will do anything for them on the basis of the relationship that He has with them. It's kind of like knowing and forgetting. We've talked about that before, right? Or remembering and forgetting is what I mean to say. When God remembers something, it's not mental recollection. It's God acting on behalf of His covenant for that person. That's what God remembering somebody means. So God forgetting somebody is not, you know, a mental blank of some kind. It's God turning His back, the covenant being broken, so forth and so on. The same thing is true with love and hate. This isn't just, you know, disgust over something. This is covenant terminology as well. It's the opposite of God loving based on the covenant, God hating based on the covenant as well. And then, I guess let me just say one more thing because I don't want to get too bogged down on too many details. The issues of kind of the high court, we might call it, in verses 8 and following of chapter 17, it's not for appeals. You know, in our culture, the higher courts are for appeals. You don't like how the court ruled, you go to a higher court and you appeal it. And if you don't like how that one ruled, you go to a higher court and you appeal it, and all the way up as high as you can go. The high court is not for appeals, it's for hard cases in Israelite society. So the idea was whoever is judging, that judgment is final wherever you may be. And this court in particular is for those difficult cases that just could not be handled in a community. So that's a few things about this section on judges. Thoughts, questions about any of it? Yes, Vanna? Yeah, something like that. Of course, there's other things going on there as well. You know, Pilate's trying to pass the buck on to Herod, who wants to pass it back to Pilate. So there's a few other things going on there, but the idea of it you know, working its way up, which is very different from Paul in Acts. You know, he's in Caesarea in prison waiting for a fair trial, and he's not getting it, so he appeals to Caesar, which is appealing to a higher court. And if they had said, you know, if Festus had said he needs to be executed, well, I appeal to Caesar, and he's appealing to a higher court. So there's different kinds of things going on in different places. But yeah, the idea of we can't handle this here, let's pass it on to somebody else is the idea. Anything else here about judges before we move on? All right, well, let's talk about kings then in verse 14. When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on his throne of the kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it in all the days of his life, and that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them. His heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. Notice there's nothing about how he's supposed to rule as a king. There's nothing political at all about this except what he's not to do, which is to multiply his military, to multiply his wives, or to multiply his money, which, by the way, are the three things that ancient Near Eastern kings invariably did. You know, we want a king just like all the rest of the people around us have kings, they said. Well, you're going to have a king, but he's not going to be anything like any other king is going to be. He's not going to multiply his military power or his harem or his wealth. That's not what's supposed to happen. What he's supposed to do is give his undivided allegiance to God. He is to take the law and write a copy of it for himself and keep it with him and read it regularly. It is to permeate his behavior in every sphere of his life. Which is, again, why I say that the king is a reflection of the model Israelite. He is showing the people what they are to be. The judges are showing the people what God is in a reflection of justice. The king is showing the people what they are supposed to be in their devotion to God. And so that's what's going on fundamentally here with this. In my reading, I came across something that just was really striking to me. I never thought about this before in my life. But Patrick Miller, in his Deuteronomy commentary, said this. He says, much has been written about the way the messianic passages of the royal Psalms and Isaiah points us to and find their actuality in Jesus of Nazareth. It is possible that we've overlooked the text that may resonate most with the kingship he manifested. He was one who sought and received none of the perquisites, the perks, basically, of kingship, who gave his full and undivided attention to God, and who lived his whole life by the instruction, the law of the Lord. So here is the king, and who the king is supposed to be in Israelite society here in Deuteronomy. It's someone who doesn't take the perks of kingship. It's someone who gives his full undivided allegiance to God. It's someone who lives his entire life by the word of God. That's what the king is supposed to be. And again, what is the ultimate manifestation of that picture except Jesus? And so I think he's right. I think we missed something. You know, let's go to the Old Testament and find some ideas of what Jesus, what the Messiah is going to be. Well, Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, 2 Samuel 7. And I don't know that I've ever heard anyone say, let's go look at Deuteronomy 17. And yet, once you see that, yeah, it's as clear as day that this is pointing us in the direction of the kind of kingship that, as Miller says, Jesus actually manifested in who he was. All right, thoughts about the text here on Kings? Yeah, Jonathan. Right. And it's, again, I think in the kind of government that we would think of, you'd say, well, the king enforces it, and, you know, the judges try the cases. But again, the focus here is not on the king enforcing it. The focus is on the king reading it and living by it, which this is one of those places where I think it's clear, a variety of things, but let me just say one thing, how important it is to know Deuteronomy as you're reading the rest of the Old Testament. Because you cannot read this and then read the beginning of Solomon's reign and not make loads and loads and loads of connections. And we'll say the same thing when we get to 27 and 28 with the blessings and curses. You cannot read those texts and then go read the prophets and not make loads and loads and loads of connections. Deuteronomy stands behind so much of the history and prophecy. Again, the history of Israel is sometimes called by scholars the Deuteronomic history. And we're not going to get into all that some people think that implies, but for our purposes, it's so rooted in Deuteronomy that you can't miss the connection. This is so fundamental to understanding the rest of the Old Testament. Well, let's keep moving and talk about priests and Levites then. In chapter 18, the Levitical priests, all the tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's food offering as their inheritance. They have no inheritance among their brothers. The Lord is their inheritance, as he promised them. And this shall be the priests' due from the people. They shall, from those offering a sacrifice, whether an ox or a sheep, they shall give to the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks, and the stomach, the first fruits of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and of the first fleece of your sheep you shall give him. For the Lord your God has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the name of the Lord, him and his sons for all time. And if a Levite comes with from any of your towns out of all Israel where he lives, and he may come when he desires to the place the Lord will choose, and ministers in the name of the Lord his God, like all his fellow Levites who stand to minister there before the Lord, then he may have equal portions to eat, because what he receives from the sale of his patrimony. Well, a couple things here. The Levites have twofold sort of service. They ministered some at the sanctuary, at the temple, and they ministered throughout the land with the preservation of the teaching of the law. And they could do either one of those things. You note that he could come from where he lives to this place. He can come whenever he desires to do that. So they could be at either place. But the focus on them not having any inheritance, we talked about this last time, that they got mentioned in some of the feast ideas, and they kind of got mentioned alongside, you know, the widows and the orphans and the foreigners and the Levites, and it's not quite that blatant, but it does seem to be implied, and it's because they live on the goodwill of the people. They don't have an inheritance. They don't have jobs that provide them some sort of salary. They are dependent on the people. The Lord is their inheritance. And what that means, practically speaking, is that they live on what is given to God. The people come and they make their offerings to God, and the priests and the Levites make their living on what is given to God. And that's a very practical way in which the Lord is their inheritance. So they're dependent on the people the same way that the widows and the orphans and the foreigners are dependent on the people as well. Notice also in verse 5, the Lord your God has chosen him out of all of your tribes to stand and minister for you. That's the same language and construction. The Lord has chosen you out of all of the nations, back in chapter 7. Just as God chose Israel out of all the nations of the earth, God has chosen the Levites out of all of the tribes of Israel. And, you know, you don't want to make too much out of that sort of thing, but at least one possible, plausible, maybe probable implication of that is that Israel should treat the Levites the same way that God has treated Israel, in terms of blessing them to an abundance. And another thing that's worth noting here is, again, how different this is from the rest of the ancient Near East, because in most places, the priesthood were major landholders. They were very wealthy and very powerful, the religious elite, where you know they've just come from. In Egypt in particular, the priestly caste was very wealthy and powerful. And so this is very different from that. You know, the exploitation of power was a real problem in a bunch of religious groups in pagan societies. And God doesn't want his people to be like that. But at the same time, the landlessness of the priests was not to impoverish them. They shouldn't be excessively wealthy like the wealthy, powerful priests in Egypt, but they shouldn't be impoverished either. And it's an Old and New Testament principle, I think, consistently, that people who give their lives to minister for God's purposes should be adequately provided for by God's people. Which is not to say they need to, you know, be flying around in private jets everywhere, but it also means they shouldn't be living from paycheck to paycheck, you know, stringing together every bean they can find to feed their children. And I think we've, in society at large, missed on both sides of that. Some people have talked about, you know, paying their preachers as little as possible as walking by faith or something, and it's really just walking in disobedience. But I don't want to be too self-serving or anything, so I'll leave that discussion where it is. Thoughts about priests and Levites? All right, moving then on to prophets. And this is an interesting one for a variety of reasons. This is a text that we sometimes think of as being about Jesus. And I certainly don't want to deny that it is about Jesus. The New Testament picks up on this language and uses it in connection to Jesus. But I don't think that it's only about Jesus. Any more than I think 2 Samuel 7's promises to David are only about Jesus. I mean, it's most clearly fulfilled in him. Yet the chronicler says it's fulfilled in Solomon, and various psalmists say it's fulfilled in other Davidic kings as well. The same thing is true here. This is pointing us in the direction of Jesus ultimately, but notice also this is in the midst of different offices, so to speak, among the people of Israel. It's not like you've got judges who are doing one thing, you've got kings who are doing one thing, and you've got priests and Levites who are doing something, and oh, by the way, Jesus is coming. No, this is another group of people who are going to be ministering in the land in some way, and it is the prophetic office that is first in view, and ultimately none of them fulfill it completely, and it points us in the direction of Jesus. Kind of like in 2 Samuel 7, it's talking about the Davidic kingship, the Davidic dynasty, but none of them fulfill that promise completely, and ultimately it points us in the direction of Jesus. So that same idea, I think, applies here. But it begins with false prophets and bad ways of trying to learn God's will. When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of these nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or interprets omens or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a necromancer or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. For these nations, which you are about to dispossess, listen to fortune tellers and to diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do this. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. Just as you desired of the Lord at Horeb, on the day of the assembly, when you said, "Let me not again hear the voice of the Lord my God, or see this great fire any more, lest I die." And the Lord said to me, "They're right in what they have spoken. I'll raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words, that he shall speak to them in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, 'How may we know that a word, the word that the Lord has not spoken?' When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if that word does not come to pass or come true, that is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You need not be afraid of him." So, again, you've got kind of three lines of defense, so to speak, of how things should be. The judges who are interpreting and applying God's law in judicial setting, the king who is representing what their life is supposed to look like by following the law himself, the priests and the Levites who are doing the ministering of the covenant in various ways. And if all else fails, there is this last line of defense, the Word of God Himself coming to the people again. And as we look at this idea of prophecy, notice that it is God's initiative. God will raise up a prophet in verses 15 and 18. It's based on God's model. It will be a prophet like Moses, not just, you know, whoever wants to come along and do it however they want to do it, which tells you if you've got a prophet, if you're living in the Old Testament, if you've got a prophet that's self-seeking, well, that's really not a prophet like Moses. If he refuses to challenge the idolatrous, that's not a prophet like Moses. If he's immoral, that's not a prophet like Moses. So that is, you know, something of a criteria in itself, that it is going to be a prophet like Moses. So it's God's initiative, God's model. It's also God's message in verse 18. He will speak to them all that I command them, and it's based on God's authority in verse 19. I myself will require it of him. So God is the one standing behind the prophet from beginning to end. Now, we also get a hint that, again, this is the prophetic office, but it's not fulfilled by any of the Old Testament prophets ultimately. If you go all the way down to the end of the book in Deuteronomy chapter 34, in verse 10, there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, which is, you know, the exact opposite of Jesus, who does know God face to face. So there has not been anyone like Moses. So these other prophets were working in this role, but not to the same degree, which is why they were still looking for the prophet who would be coming along when you get to the New Testament time period. By the way, that also points us in the direction way back in our introductory class. We talked about Deuteronomy being Mosaic, that it has a Mosaic core, that these were indeed the sermons of Moses, and Moses may well have written down some of it, but the final form of Deuteronomy comes after the time of Moses. And we don't know exactly when that was or who that final author was, but those statements, you know, Moses was the meekest man on all the earth, sounds like an odd thing for Moses to write. The death of Moses, unless he's writing it prophetically, God could have inspired Moses to write his own death prophetically. That's certainly possible. But it's more natural to not read it that way. And that verse, verse 10, really doesn't make any sense. Since the time of me, and I haven't died yet because I'm writing this prophetically, there has not been another prophet like me. Well, that's just fantastic. In the last negative 5 minutes before your death, there's not been a prophet like you. That's very impressive. And also then it points you to it being a bit later, whenever this final form came into place. And again, that's not to say that that final author wasn't inspired or anything like that. But if it was written by Joshua, I mean, that's kind of a common thing, right? Well, Moses died, so Joshua finished it up. Well, yeah, okay, so Moses has been dead for 30 minutes now. Since Moses died, there's not been a prophet like him. Oh wow, really impressive. So again, it points us to the final form being a little bit later than we may kind of traditionally think of if we think of Mosaic authorship. So that's something we've just got to keep in balance. The core of this is Mosaic, beyond all doubt in my mind, but the final form, whoever that final inspired author or editor was, does come at some point later. Now, as to determining true and false prophecy, there's just a single criteria given, and that is fulfillment. But notice it's not a positive criteria, it's a negative criteria. What that means is if it's not fulfilled, then it didn't come from God. It does not say that if it is fulfilled, then it definitely did come from God. Because back in chapter 13, we already saw somebody might prophesy and it might come true, but if he leads the people astray, he's not a true prophet. So this criteria alone, it's a disqualifier, but by itself, it's not a qualifier. Now, how useful is this as a criteria if you've got two different people prophesying different things like Jeremiah and Hananiah at the same time? By the time what Jeremiah says comes to pass, it's too late for anyone to say, oh, I guess Jeremiah was right, we better repent. The temple's already been destroyed, you've already been carried off into captivity, it's too late. So it's not that kind of criteria for them to judge in the moment. There are other things for that, like is it consistent with what God has said? And that's back in Deuteronomy 13, and that's how the people of Jeremiah's day should have made that that kind of judgment. Kristen?
So is God
side. And so, yeah, that's those kinds of things. That's how people in the ancient world tried to tell the future. And there are different people have different thoughts about that specifically, and I don't want to get too much into the nuts and bolts of that. But I mean, what some people will say is, well, they were just doing something and it had no basis in reality, and every now and then they'd get lucky. I don't know that I think that's what the Old Testament depicts. I think the Old Testament depicts those people being in league with, whether they knew it or not, being in league with Satan and his forces. And so there was something behind that. I mean, the medium of Endor calls up Samuel. Either that kind of thing never happened and she surprised herself, or those kinds of things were happening. You know, everything else had been a sham, and whoa, how did I do this? And God was behind it for his own purposes, or again. So without getting into all of that, yeah, the basic idea is these other things are going on. Whether there's reality in it or not is a different issue. But if they do this and they say something and it comes true, that doesn't necessarily mean that that message has come from God. But if it doesn't come true, then you know for certain that it didn't come from God. So something like that. Other thoughts on prophets here? Yeah, Tom?
Same with me. What the warnings have in common is, you know, these are efforts to know the future. But no one just has an interest in knowing the future. They want to control it.
Yeah.
But God's revelation is for that purpose. So if we turn the Bible into some kind of certain knowledge that we have, that we have some sense of control, we're really just committed another form of idolatry and witchcraft and so on. We're just using the Bible to do that. So God's revelation is always, yeah, here's the things you need to know, but ultimately you have to trust in the Lord and rely on Him. And it is about your self-control.
Very good. All right, moving then on into chapter 19, we move to various kinds of criminal law. Starting with what in our culture we'd call manslaughter, accidental killing of someone, not a premeditated sort of killing, which is a move, again, if you're thinking of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, this is a move from honor your father and mother to you shall not kill. But this is also where it gets a little bit loose, because in this chapter we're not just going to find you shall not kill, we're also going to find you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness, and you shall not covet your neighbor's property. So again, those who see this as some sort of rigid formula, it really doesn't work out precisely that way. But again, you'll find hints of the Ten Commandments in a lot of this. So verses 1 through 13, when the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, you shall set apart three cities for yourself in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. You shall measure the distances and divide the three parts into three parts, the area of the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a possession, so that any manslayer can flee to them. This is the provision for that manslayer, who by fleeing there may save his life. If anyone kills his neighbor unintentionally, without having hated him in the past, and as when someone goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down a tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies, he may flee to one of these cities and live, lest the avenger of blood in hot anger pursue the manslayer and overtake him, because the way is long, and strike him fatally, though the man did not deserve to die, since he had not hated his neighbor in the past. Therefore I command you, you shall set apart three cities. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he swore to your father, and gives you all the land that he promised to give to your fathers, provided you were careful to keep all this commandment, which I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, and by walking ever in his ways, then you shall add three other cities to these three, lest innocent blood be shed in your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, and so the guilt of the blood shed be upon you. But if anyone hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and attacks him and strikes him fatally so that he dies, and he flees into one of these cities, then the elders of that city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die. Your eyes shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. Well, the cities of refuge are talked about in more detail in other places, of course. This is really more about the principle, the theological principle that stands behind it, which is the shedding of innocent blood must not happen. The accidental killer needs protection from the injustice of a wrongful vengeance killing, just like a premeditated murder victim needs the vindication of justice. The innocent should not be punished, the guilty should not be unpunished. I mean, that's what it all boils down to. And it's pretty simple and straightforward as far as it goes. I'm going to work my way through this chapter, and then I'll open it up for discussions. Verse 14 is just an odd thing to show up. It's kind of its own idea, and I'm not entirely sure how it fits with everything else in chapter 19, so if you've got a brilliant idea, by all means, you can share it in a few moments. You shall not move your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in the inheritance that you will hold in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. So, you know, your inheritance is your inheritance that God has given you, and, you know, this is your coveting of your neighbor's property, and your theft is basically what this would fall under the broader heading of. One thing that might connect it to the rest of things is because the inheritance was the means of economic survival for the people. Theft of the inheritance was an attack on their livelihood. That's a bit of a stretch to get that to fit in with killing, but that's the closest I've been able to come to. And then the end of this chapter has to do again with justice. A single witness shall not suffice against any person, a person for any crime, for any wrong in connection with any offense that he's committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who were in office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest of the con, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity; it shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So a couple of things here about witnesses. I mean, obviously, great care and diligence in establishing the truth of the case. There must be at least two or three witnesses. Single witness alone is never enough to establish the truth of the case. We saw this last week, we saw it again earlier today, and I didn't make a comment on it then, but the witness shall be the one that throws the first stone, which is a significant kind of deterrent of its own when you stop and you think about it, because if you're a false witness, that's turning you from a false witness into a murderer. If you're killing someone who is innocent of the charge, you have conspired against them, you've lied about them, and now you have had the first hand in killing them. And that by itself, talk about escalating pretty quickly, that is what you've brought upon yourself. Now there's a new deterrent added to it. You shall have done to you as you meant to do to him. And what that really means is whatever the punishment would have been for the crime you accused him of, that's the punishment you get for perjuring yourself in court. You want to talk about a deterrent for perjury? That's a pretty good one. You go lie under oath, and what you get is what that person would have gotten if the case had been successful against him. It's a pretty strong deterrent as far as it goes. Now this lex talionis, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, is caricatured frequently as a law of justice and not justice, retribution and vengeance. It's really the opposite of that. It's designed to limit vengeance, not to condone vengeance. It's a principle of proportionality. In our culture, you know, in our culture, what I was going to say is you get this, you know, you poked out my eye, I'll kill you. In reality, in our culture, it's you cut me off in traffic, I'll kill you. I mean, that's where we are as a culture right now. You're talking about unjust, out of proportion vengeance. This is designed to restrict it. So the worst that can happen to you is what you did to someone else. And as far as that goes, I don't even think it's necessarily intended to be followed literally all the way down. There are other forms of proportionate compensation that the law talks about, even in places, in terms of paying somebody a monetary kind of compensation. You know, you've disabled his livelihood in some way by, you know, doing something that made him lose his hand. Well, maybe that means your hand gets cut off. Maybe what that means is you pay his way for the rest of his life. Whatever he would have been able to earn with two hands, you make that up financially. So there are other ways other than literally following this that you see it worked out as far as it goes. All right, any thoughts here on this? And then we have one more section. Yeah, Jonathan? Yeah, yeah.
Is verse 14 a continuation of geographic justice?
Yeah. It certainly kind of fits into that general framework. And also, I mean, it is moving from cities of refuge to property boundaries to justice in the court. So it's not like, you know, killing random law, more killing. Although I think that's kind of how people typically read verses 15 and following. Yeah. Right, and that even begins up in verses 1 and following, the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you're dispossessing them and you're taking it. So the idea of this being an inheritance is certainly an idea that flows through it. Yeah, Tom?
It occurred to me that, you know, these might be really two of the most significant cases that would appear in the court. You know, life and death issue with
property. So two different kinds of illustrations. Yeah.
Could moving the landmarks, the boundaries, be a form of false witness? And these are used illegally for establishing inheritance and the property and all that. You were tampering with the evidence, so to speak?
It certainly is a form of dishonesty. Whether it would move all the way into a false witness sort of category is an interesting thought. I don't know where I would, I don't know where I'd rule on that issue. Right, right. It'll preach, right? Yeah.
Say about our civilized society, yeah. One area where this disproportionate response strikes me is on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
You make any comment that someone doesn't like, and he just, you know, death threats and things like that, it's completely out of
control. Yeah.
And yet we're civilized.
Right. Of course. That's a couple comments I read. I nearly wrote them down, but you know, the way we judge ancient society, and you look around the world, and it's not just that we're not any better, we're so much worse. It occurs to me that all the people who usually ring the bell aren't here, so I think I can just take my time, because it should have been rung 2 minutes ago. The second bell should have been rung 2 minutes ago. So I'll read through chapter 20 real fast if someone wants to go give that a ring, and then maybe a minute or two, and then the second ring, so they're not completely blindsided by it. Chapter 20, when you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priests shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory. Then the officers shall speak to his people, saying, 'Is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicated it. Is there any man who's planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man enjoy his fruit. Is there any man who is a betrothed wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man take her.' And the officers shall speak further to the people and say, 'Is any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own.' And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. If it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it to your hand, you shall put all of its males to the sword, but the women and the little ones, the livestock, and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves, and you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. But in the cities of the peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. You shall devote them to complete destructions, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices, as they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war with it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food. Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may cut, destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. Let me read a couple quotes here that I think are interesting. Actually, let me say one thing first, and I'll read a couple of quotes. To build a house but not live in it, plant a vineyard but not enjoy its fruit, betroth a wife but not marry her. These are all different elements of ancient Near Eastern futility curses. You know, I curse you, may you have a field but never eat its fruit. May you have a woman but never be able to marry her. Those are kinds of ancient curses. The fact that someone could be slain in battle in circumstances that would make him look to be cursed, the enjoyment of blessing in the land is exactly what God is trying to give them, that they would die without experiencing those blessings. That's what's trying to be avoided here. Now, that said, let me read to you two quotes. These are both from Christopher Wright in his Deuteronomy commentary. He says, "Love of a neighbor clearly does not mean facile niceness to everybody in all circumstances. Likewise, the historical execution of divine justice upon the wickedness of the Canaanites is not incompatible with the overall belief in God's ultimate intention to bless nations through Israel, nor does it prevent the remarkable degree of social compassion and legal protection afforded to the foreigner within Israel, even in Deuteronomy. The mere fact, then, that Deuteronomy makes provision for war does not invalidate all that it has to say concerning human ethical duties of compassion, neighborliness, and generosity," which I think is an interesting thing to begin with as you consider this. But then this is what he says toward the end of his discussion of Deuteronomy 20. He says, "Without a Geneva Convention, Deuteronomy advocates human exemptions from combat, requires prior negotiation, prefers nonviolence, limits the treatment of subject populations, allows for the execution of male combatants only, demands humane and dignified treatment of female captives, and insists on ecological restraint," which is just a fascinating. When you look at this, I mean, there's the little section about the war against the Canaanites themselves in the middle of all of this, but everything else about war is again, you compare it to all the things that the people say today, and this is the right way of doing war. I mean, it's a hard sentence to say, given the ugliness of what it is. But the laws here are as good as you're ever going to find, and that really shouldn't be too surprising of a thing. All right, any last comments here on Deuteronomy 20? We're beyond out of time. So, yeah, Gwen. Yeah, and my guess is that some of that, at least, is coming out of the context of Leviticus itself, where, I mean, kind of the drum that gets beaten in Leviticus over and over and over is, you are a holy people. You are holy to God. And what that means, then, is on the other side of it, you've got to get the evil out. And so that idea of who you are supposed to be means you've got to keep the evil out of you, because it's going to be this negative influence. And so purging the evil is certainly, yeah, I think it's a connecting idea that goes from passage to passage as it is applied in those different contexts. All right. Thank you for your attention and patience. We'll move on to the last section, 21 through 26, and then 27 and 28 will be a different class where we get to slow down a little bit more.